Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of eDiscovery After Hours. My guest this week is Christine Payne from Gunster, and she's also involved with a new initiative called the Mind Budget Connection. So we talk about what that is and how it came about and what they're hoping to accomplish. We talked about her background growing up in Colorado and how she landed in Texas, and how in the world she became an art history major and what that was all about. So this is a great episode. Christine is wonderful, and I know that you are going to love it. Our sponsor this week is Discovery Master. When you are tracking document review projects in Relativity, whether you are just trying to automate project metrics or QC stats or both, if you're looking at one instance of Relativity or multiple on-prem, RHEL 1, you name it, and you just want one place to log in and see everything, check out discoverymaster.co. Thanks for tuning in.
You don't know how to drink, your whole generation.
Drinks on the house.
Yes, sir.
Now, wait a second. Drinks are 50% off.
Right.
Now, wait a second. Double the price of everything.
And I work only 16 hours a day.
A union man only works 8 hours a day.
I belong to two unions.
And now, eDiscovery After Hours with your host, Ryan Short.
All right, Christine, cheers. Welcome to eDiscovery After Hours.
Thank cheers.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
What are we working on here? What's in the mug?
This is tea. This is black tea. I don't drink coffee, so I have like a steady infusion of just straight black tea all day long. And I don't know that it is any healthier or better. It's what I do.
It's just what you do. Mm-hmm. Is not drinking coffee, is that a conscious choice? How did this come about?
No, it's just that I'm a brat and I think coffee is yucky.
So I agreed with you for like 31 years, and I got a job at a scale-up company who had already outgrown our office space when we joined. There was like 26 employees and like 18 desks. And so if you wanted to have a private conversation with somebody, you had to walk down the block to the coffee shop. And so I went from thinking that coffee smelled revolting, tasted revolting, was a huge waste of money, to having like 3 to 4 cups a day. And then I got hooked, and I didn't realize I got hooked until I was on vacation a couple months into that job. And I went 2 or 3 days without having coffee because that wasn't part of my morning routine. And I was like, why do I have this splitting headache? And my wife is like, you're dumb and you're going through caffeine withdrawal. So it's a real thing. So now I'm a full on addict. So good for you for sticking with the tea.
One time when I was a baby lawyer at Kirkland, I also had the splitting headache, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong, and I was cranky, and nothing was going well. And then at some point I realized that some like very twisted person had replaced the tea in like the little cantina with decaf. Like, I don't even understand who drinks decaf tea. Like, why is that a thing? But it had all been like surreptitiously switched out. And that was mean.
So. Tea's magical. It can do all kinds of crazy things. My wife drinks special teas when she's pregnant or when she's nursing, or like all these magical, just scary things. But there you go. Well, it's really good to meet you. We have chatted once or twice before, but now it's official and the world will hear, or like, you know, all dozens or hundreds of people, depending on the episode of this show, will know regardless. I've been aware of who you are as I've, you know, kind of watched your last few landing spots. And then there's a cool thing that we're going to talk about towards the end of this conversation called the Mind Budget Connection. So there's a teaser. But first, ladies and gentlemen, let's go back to the beginning. Where are you from originally?
I was raised in Colorado, in northern Colorado, in Port Collins, which is kind of up near the Wyoming border. And then I went to high school there. I went to college in Colorado. So that's probably home, but I don't live there anymore. And I say that Texas is home now.
are you or were you really outdoorsy? I know very little about Colorado, except that I don't know why anybody there has houses, because all they ever do is, all my friends who are there, all I ever see them is like on a ski lift or in a kayak or in a tent. And I'm like, why do houses exist in Colorado? Did you fit into that bucket?
Yeah, I think so. Although, you know, Colorado is surprisingly complex. There's a lot of ranchers there. Even people who are in the mountains are sometimes farm focused. And so there's outdoorsy because people are, you know, hikers or they're enjoying it for recreation. And then there's also just people who are outdoorsy because that's part of the way they make a living.
Yeah. Yeah, it is the downside of where I live. Wonderful people. I mean, we don't have like natural disasters or anything, but there's nothing outdoorsy about Indianapolis, Indiana. So we had very different upbringings, I think, from that perspective, you and I. Now you, if memory serves, when I was doing my LinkedIn stalking earlier, do you have an art history degree? What did you do in undergrad?
I do. I have an art history degree. I thought that at one point I was going to be a doctor. And then I failed out of organic chemistry.
Yeah, that's the one that gets you.
So decided instead that I would go to law school and decided that if I could go with any degree, I might as well have fun and really enjoy it. And so went to get an art history degree. It was awesome. It's really fun.
So are you an artist?
No. They make you take certain classes. Like I took a drawing class, I took a photography class so that you can kind of appreciate that side of it. But I was like the weird kid in the back who couldn't do anything. And that was okay.
So of all of the majors in at UC, you think if I can do anything at all, I'm going to go do this art history thing because I saw a pretty painting once, but you weren't an artist yourself. That's kind of a crazy thing. What was that initial spark that drew you to that degree?
I had an amazing teacher in high school named Bill Bradley who taught, an art history class. And I think I took it initially because it was after lunch and, you know, back then they had slides. Right. Yeah. Remember slides. Yeah. And the room was dark. It was like an auditorium type room and it was dark. And I thought like that would be so cozy after lunch. I could, you know, kind of like recuperate there. And then I just really loved it. It's a really cool way to think about the world. And I mean, it's really it's history, but through the lens of the way in which people are expressing themselves through art. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I dig that. So I am, I'm from a small town, Muncie, Indiana. It's a Rust Belt town, you know, formerly tens of thousands of auto jobs that are not there anymore, but there's still a university there and a hospital. Mm-hmm. And so there's a modicum of culture more so than other towns that size. And right now at the cultural center in town is the Bob Ross Experience. I did not realize this, but evidently when I was growing up, that's where he filmed his show, was in my hometown. And then I saw, did you see the documentary that came out about him recently? I don't know if it was on Netflix or Amazon Prime.
No, I've read about it. I don't know that I can watch it because I don't want anything to ruin my Bob Ross experience.
Yes.
Which was very zen and cool. As a kid?
Yes. Yeah. His life, I'll tell you, was not full of happy trees. There was dark and scary trees. It was quite a thing.
Yeah. I'm not ready for that.
I dig it. All right. So you, you come out of UC Go Buffs and, somehow you stumble down and you find yourself in Austin, Texas. How does this happen?
That's where I went to law school.
Yeah.
And I went to Texas because when I was at CU, I was on the rowing team, which is a surprisingly good little team for not having a large body of water available. You know, there's like a very small little reservoir and you can go in circles. And so we used to go down for races and other things to Austin. And I thought, this place is amazing. I want to be there forever. And so I applied to law school there and it was an awesome, really fun school, probably a little too fun. Anyway, I've lived some other places. I lived in Chicago for a while right after law school, but you know, Austin kind of is easy to go back to. So it's been home now again for a little bit more than a decade.
Yeah. Nice. I, just last week I was in, Georgia for a big family reunion, and I was talking to my uncle who moved down to Austin in, 1981 or 1982. And he was like, yeah, it was like this boring mid-sized city of like 350,000 people that had like a hospital in the state capital and nothing else. And IBM, which is why he was recruited down there. He was like, and it was IBM. And everybody was like, what are these computer things, you know? And so he's been in Austin for, you know, 40 years now. And he's like, it literally is night and day, like not the same place. And he loves it. But it's kind of funny because it's got that tech buzz, right? And South by Southwest and Keep Austin Weird. And he's like, none of that existed. That was not a thing. So he's lived through like seeing Austin become Austin today. So there you go. Who knew?
Amazing. It's a wonderful place, but it is currently like just like reckless extravagance. It is, and it's a very divide. It's interestingly, it is the most racially divided city in the country if you look at geography. And so really? That is something that we, you know, there are initiatives in the city to try and ameliorate, but there's a highway that goes right up the middle of the city and it is east and west. And so there's just tons and tons of money pouring in, and there's too many Maseratis and Lamborghinis, you know, they just like crowd the streets. And that sounds outrageous, I know, but it's just, I don't think the city has exactly a good hold on what the next 5 to 10 years are going to bring. But it's not the sleepy little town of the 80s. It's not even the same as, you know, when I went to law school there. And unfortunately for us, you know, like the musicians and the artists and the things that made the city really beautiful, they're getting priced out and right. have to go elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Man. So yeah, you're like a crusty old local at this point, like these dang tech kids with their Maseratis, you know,
kind of get off the lawn.
Oh my goodness. All right. So, you bounce around then and you get a job at, you know, like the biggest, baddest law firm, on the planet. And you read that for a long time. And I mean, that's a feather in anybody's cap. Right. And then, what intrigues me about you is that you're clearly not afraid of a challenge because Kirkland is intimidating. Right. And then Redgrave has an incredible reputation. And then you go and start a new adventure, right. And build this new monster at what you're doing now. So kind of talk through, how do you kind of vet career opportunities and decide that, you know, the risk, you know, the reward is worth the risk, right? And I mean, you can get into any specifics or be as general as you want, but I think a lot of times, you know, there's excitement, but a lot of trepidation as people try to decide, like, is this other opportunity really something that I should pursue? Or is this one of those kind of the grass is always greener situations? So we'd love to hear a little bit about how you have kind of refined your approach to making that judgment call.
Mm-hmm. You know, Kirkland is really big and maybe intimidating, but it's not bad. And I had a wonderful, wonderful experience there. And, you know, the group of people that I found to work with and to be friends with and were wonderful. And it made it a great experience. So I don't think I had necessarily the big firm experience that some people have. And, you know, the other really amazing thing about a place like Kirkland is that, you know, those guys are really good at business and they're printing money. And so it's incredibly stable. Yeah. And they really, really know what they're doing. So why in God's name would anyone ever step outside of that is, if that is your real question. It's not a bad question. But the answer is very unique to the e-discovery practice, right? E-discovery is this kind of like strange animal where within large firms and within big firms, it's absolutely necessary. You know, you have to have tremendous e-discovery experience to be able to handle cases that you know, like the size and shape of what Kirkland handles. But for me, I also kind of saw that there was an opportunity to be entrepreneurial outside of the big firm space, working alongside them. Sometimes clients actually prefer that either for conflicts reasons or for rate flexibility or to position discovery counsel in between large firms that are working together on a single matter. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, like I could do that, you know, and use everything that I have and, you know, the experience that I've gained kind of on the inside and see if I can kind of ride along shotgun a little bit on the outside. You know, our kind of business model is we're never competitive. We are there to make merits counsel shine and to make them look like rock stars so that they never have to worry about discovery becoming a headache. And so, e-discovery as a major practice area within a huge law firm it's not a big enough revenue driver to really be something that any firm is going to, like, you know, it would never be have its own department along the size of bankruptcy or corporate or anything like that. It's not like that. Right. But it is a necessary practice and there is the opportunity to be in a cooperative role. And that's what we do. And I really, it's been wonderful and it's working and I love it.
Yeah. And big kudos to you. And my real question was not why would you leave? Right. I mean, because people have asked me the same thing, right? I mean, I was in Chicago working for an industry leader, publicly traded, you know, advancing career and all this. And I was like, oh, let's go try something else at a smaller shop, right? And there's to your point about being entrepreneurial, you know, when you're in a big machine, you can learn a lot. And frankly, as people have asked me similar questions, what I asked you, I tell them, like, I think there's a lot of value in starting your career at, you know, at an Am Law 100 firm, at a Fortune 500 company, at a, you know, whatever the industry big behemoth is, because you can learn so much, you know, domain knowledge and you can learn how the different pieces of a mature organization interplay. And then you can take that and go do something smaller and more entrepreneurial and kind of take the best, the best pieces that you see and apply those and create something new that can, you know, iterate or disrupt or provide a different experience for clients. So I think it's fantastic. Now I want to get back to this mind budget connection that we teased earlier. So Chad Riley is a friend of mine over at Sandline and he reached out and was telling me about this survey that's going to be coming out. And we'd love to get Christine on the show. I saw that you were just on George Socha's thing. So there's a really impressive group of people associated with this initiative. So would be really interested to hear more about what it is, how it came about, and what you guys are driving at here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am so lucky that these people let me hang out with them. So the Mind Budget Connection is a small group of like-minded folks in the e-discovery industry who we are working together kind of on a volunteer basis to explore whether there are structural changes we could make or advocate that might help mental health outcomes for service providers in the e-discovery industry. And we call it the Mind Budget Connection because I guess I typically and others seem to focus on the mind-body connection. We're science is really helping us understand that a lot more. But when we look at what is really driving stress and stress-related burnout and illness in amongst e-discovery professionals, a lot of it has to do with budgets. And so we thought, well, what if we could fix that problem? Or even ameliorate it just a little bit. Could we help people there? And so that's our overall initiative. And we really do have some awesome folks. We have Kevin Brady from VW, Amy Sellers from CBRE, Stacy Sampek from 3M, Chad, who you mentioned. And then we are so lucky in that we're working with Logan Cornett, who's the director of research at the University of Denver's Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System. I always say that wrong, but it's IAALS. And that was something that I did not know existed, but I'm so thankful for them and the work that they do. And Logan in particular is just incredibly smart and thoughtful and has really helped us kind of shape the way in which we can go about understanding, either through surveys or interviews, like how can we start to get our hands around what the actual problem is and then start to make some suggestions.
So is this obviously there's no secret, and it's not unique to eDiscovery, that people are stressed, right? And then they're working crazy hours, and with so much remote work, it's hard to turn it off and walk away, right? Like, I am physically in the office most days because I'm a better husband and father, because that physical separation helps change my mindset, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't have that today. They're working from home, so that laptop, that cell phone, that tablet, everything's always right within arm's reach. So the genesis of this initiative makes a lot of sense to me. I guess the question then is, you guys aren't like an advocacy group that says, here are the reforms that we are hammering for, right? And we're gonna lobby clients to change the way they structure MSAs, and we're gonna lobby, you know, bar associations to educate the, you know, whatever. So, tell me, what do you anticipate this will look like? How can people get involved, and what kind of contributions do you think would advance, you know, the goals to helping to address some of these concerns?
Yeah, no, what we're aiming for is something far more subtle, which is just to see if we could offer some suggestions to folks who are structuring projects and who are in the contract negotiation stage and thinking about how an e-discovery project is going to be handled, how it's going to be staffed. What if we could give those folks some principles to consider or principles to talk about that might help, you know, our engagement agreements be successful from the start? Something that we see a lot of is an engagement agreement where there's underbidding for some reason. Either a vendor has come in, right? Because we have a race to the bottom on pricing. So a vendor has come in and they feel like they have to, you know, bid $2 like for the project, you know, just where it's an extreme underbidding situation, or, you know, on the law firm side where, you know, clients are either asking for a special fee, you know, arrangement or a flat fee, and, you know, you're not setting it up realistically. In those situations where it's poorly structured from the beginning and never really has a chance of working, like, a vendor's only hope is to either renegotiate the contract midstream, or, you know, the only things that they can kind of toggle are putting fewer people on a project and taking other people off and having them go to other projects that are higher realization. And so what that does in either the law firm context or the vendor context is it leaves an understaffing situation. So if you have a project that requires 10 people, you know, they might assign two, and those two people are typically very skilled, very proud professionals who absolutely will try to get the job done, but they might run themselves into the ground trying. And so if you have, you know, just project after project after project that is like that, you have to kind of stop and say, well, why is it always like this? Why are we having situations where there's not an adequate budget to get the necessary work done? Why are we understaffed? And that's kind of what we're hoping to spur a conversation about.
Interesting. Well, whether it's about, you know, the practice group that you're building or the Mind Budget Connection, where can folks reach you? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
You can reach me at my Gunster email address, cpayne@gunster.com. I'm on the website. but also I'm on LinkedIn and love talking about eDiscovery or love talking about mental health in our community and what our community means to me and, you know, how we participate that and how we define ourselves.
Excellent. Well, cheers. Thanks again for coming on the show, Christine.
Cheers. Thank you for having me.